he is brave, strong, and stout as ox. Just very swiftly recapitulate the question, and if I destroy the process, you have a right to object. Okay? Maybe Jesus didn't exist at all. I would consider Jesus' existence and, in fact, his crucifixion as historically secure as anything is ever historically secure. My reason is that, apart completely from the Christian sources, from Tacitus and Josephus, when you remove the Christian overlays from him, they agree on three things. There was a movement over there in Palestine. We executed the founder of that movement, and darn it, the movement has spread all the way to Rome. And that's not bad. I mean, it's not everything, but it really is very good. There was a movement, we killed the founder, and not only did it continue, it spread all the way to Rome. Josephus says those who loved him before continued to love him afterwards, and Tacitus, with a marvelous sneer, says, well, it's come all the way to Rome where everything rotten arrives eventually. Tell us more than he existed, so I would feel as secure as anything I could ever do.
Okay, I follow up. Most of the stuff, like Tacitus, and I'm not sure about this, but the writings, weren't they basically talking about the church over centuries? I mean, especially, and isn't it possible that, I mean, it's even conceivable that maybe this whole thing was made up of power? Because that, okay, when you look at suppression of heresy, for instance, what is that? That's consolidation of power. Because what difference does it make? Mm-hmm. Is it possible, and especially if you read what Josephus wrote about Jesus, that certainly was like a revelation. And because of the fact that the church copied these manuscripts and it came down to the church, is it not possible that there could be a major deception?
Is it possible? Yes. We have to face the fact that in historical matters, and now we all know even in current matters, in a trial, the most we can ever get at the end of life and death is 12 people to say this was proved and this was not. No, there is no absolute certainties in history. But everything that I know from historical background, not only that, but the difficulty this church is having with this guy Jesus. He's like a time bomb in the basement. You never know when he's going to go off again. You really start off with somebody who is in radical critique of the status quo. And that won't go away. You can cover it and cover it and cover it, but it's there all the time. If they invented Jesus, then I don't know how this whole process really operated. That doesn't prove it couldn't happen, because there's no way on earth that that can be proved. It simply means of those two options, I find this one much more persuasive, that it did exist. But remember, in historical reconstruction, That's what we're really saying. We're not saying this is impossible. We're saying we weigh this evidence and come down to this side of the other. I would never say it's impossible. You should never use that term. And then you could use it, you know, you're being a rhetorical overkill or something. But what you really mean is, in my best historical judgment, I think this is the best shot. And we should settle for that. It's not nothing, because it is our best. Gentlemen, back.
Are you saying then that Jesus' eschatology was mainly sapiential rather than apocalyptic? That seemed to be the implication of what you said after you introduced those two terms.
I would say that, yes. Let me just unpack it a little bit more. I think there was an awful lot of apocalyptic eschatology around. I think John the Baptist was, as clearly as I can see, an apocalyptic eschatologist. And by the way, I have nothing against apocalyptic eschatology. The only question I ask of it is an ethical question: for whom is it speaking? If it's speaking for the rather well-to-do, then I get nervous about it. But John the Baptist was an apocalyptic eschatologist. Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist. Again, I'd say that's another thing where it's as sure as anything we know. So at least for the 5 minutes he was under the water, he had to be an apocalyptic eschatologist. I couldn't understand him simply accepting John's vision, you know. So I think Jesus started off as an apocalyptic eschatologist. Now, I'm not arguing that a lot of sayings that have come down to us where he's been apocalyptic, they refer to that 5-minute period. But I am is, I think, this is reconstruction now. I think the death of John the Baptist and the non-intervention of God taught Jesus a hard lesson. That is not how God works. Or at least, that is not how Jesus began to see God work. So I think when you start getting Jesus's, in my reconstruction, most surely original stuff, it's sapiential eschatology I keep seeing all the time. Now the early church had all sorts of people who were probably even listening to Jesus, hearing what he was saying and reinterpreting it right in the distance between the speaker and the hearer, as yeah, he's with John, he's one of us, he's okay. Because it's a very delicate difference, and what I tried to do there was not caricature either of them, but to insist, not that apocalyptic means that you don't do anything. Of course, you can pray, you can wait, you can hope. God's going to do it. There is nothing you can do except pray and wait and hope and be holy, which is not nothing, but it's still not doing it. The challenge of sapiential eschatology is that we're called by God to do a job. And there's simply different visions. I don't know necessarily that one is automatically right, the other is automatically wrong. I can see the difference between the two visions. I do not think that one is right and one is wrong. I think you could go perverse ways in either. But what I've been trying to do is to see as clearly as we can what's the difference. I think the sapientia is important because it comes out of the wisdom tradition that says, in effect, all of us here should have the same wisdom. Now, whether we have the nerve to do it is another question, but that's the way I understand the challenge. It is sapiential eschatology. And maybe, you know, the terms I've used, when I don't want to use that language, which may turn people who've never heard it off, I use social revolution. But very radical social revolution, in the name of God. Yes, gentlemen.
Tell us what you have said. Do you see any relevance to two modern phenomena? What you said. One phenomenon is the rise of the religious right. The other is the tragedy of right in the black ghetto.
I take it for granted that any movement should have a left wing, a center, and a right wing. It was there, as far as I can see, according to Galatians in the Jerusalem Conference. The far right is referred to by Paul charmingly as the false brethren, who I'm sure did not think of themselves as the false brethren. What they call Paul is not on the record. So, in one sense, I'm quite willing to figure that that is normal. I think, however, if the right wing of Christianity thinks it is Christianity, it is sadly mistaken. It is not Christianity. It is part of Christianity. What I think is needed is the center of Christianity to retake its heritage. And I would hope, though this is not why I did it, but this is one of the results I would hope, is that by beginning again and taking a look at the story of Jesus, and not stopping there, of course, that that is what we are starting to do. And I would hope that part of why the religious right is so annoyed that some people from the center, or even maybe a little bit radical, left of center, are getting media attention, is because that was supposed to be their territory. So there is something cultural going on. Now, in terms of the black ghetto, I don't know enough to really say anything intelligent, to be honest with you. But as I understand what is supposed to happen, I deliberately am not talking about the search for the historic of Jesus, for that sounds like we're going to get it once and for all. And that's really 19th century thinking. And that's what's wrong with the 19th century search. Not that it got the wrong Jesus, but it thought whatever Jesus had got would be it forever. I don't think like that. I think that each generation, each age in the church has to do its historical work too. Do it the best it can, as honest as it can, with all the ifs and buts and maybes of historical reconstruction. Ifs and buts and maybes are in a reconstruction of the text. And then the church must look at that Jesus and say, what does that Jesus then mean for us now? That is the full cycle. And I see that mirrored in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's what they're doing. They're talking about the 30s, as it were, but no, they're not. They're talking about the 30s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. Totally integrated. We should stop just quoting them, but take them seriously as a model and do the same. We have to do our historical work, then our theological work. Then I think Christianity becomes alive again in the center. There's a lady way, way back. Take it, please.
Could you describe how your scholarship concerning the story of Jesus may have influenced your view of Jesus' humanity versus Jesus' divinity?
Did everyone hear the question? Could I explain how my scholarship with regard to the historic of Jesus might have influenced how I see the humanity and divinity of Jesus? Is that more or less okay? I think my own sensibility, and I really mean sensibility, not denominational tags, is profoundly Roman Catholic. Whenever I get this either or, as I said, I keep going for a both and. I think we were supposed to believe that Jesus was 100% human and 100% divine. And I think we have cheated terribly down the years by letting those kind of slide together. They do in the gospel, but that's fine, because the gospel never said it was doing history. Said it was doing gospel. So we've taken that and said, well, that's history. And that's profoundly wrong. So what I understand is when you're doing your historical work, you have to be convinced to be honest in Schweitzer's term. It's a hard school of honesty. But you have to be secure enough to know, and I spent 20 years in a Roman Catholic religious order from the Middle Ages, and I'm profoundly convinced that reason and revelation never are at war with one another, that no matter what I find there, is not in any way going to change my faith. Because whatever was found there, somebody in that first century looked at that and said, this is God at work. Now, if I can't look at what I find and imagine, or I go farther than that, see myself saying, yep, I see God at work there, then I haven't found the historic of Jesus. I cannot imagine anyone wanting to find God in this person or thinking God was at work in this person, then I'm not talking about Jesus. So that is the test of you might want to say yourself, yeah, I see how they did it, but I can't agree with that. Alright, that's fair enough. So I have found that what it did for me as a Christian, as a Roman Catholic, was make it profoundly possible to believe that God was in Jesus. Now notice my language. I'm presuming that any act of faith means a believer, let's say God or some transcendental manifestation, so if we're outside Christianity or Western religions, in some material representation from the point of view of some believer. It's an interactive group. It's not so much a substantial, essential thing like, is Jesus divine in the same way that he is, say, Galilean or something. It takes an act of faith. I mean, the shocking way to put this is if nobody believed Jesus was divine, Jesus was not divine. That's the shocking way to make it clear. Which means, of course, if we don't, he ain't. And all the discussions about it as a sort of an abstract phenomenon don't let us out of the hook. I feel absolutely no tension, at least between what I understand it means to say somebody is divine and what I'm learning about Jesus. I'm going to take the lady back here. Yeah?
Just maybe my need to do a both and with eschatology. But it strikes me that the two kinds of eschatology you're talking about come together for me with a discernment of what time it is. There's a job to be done, and there is a specific time to do it, which may not be 10 minutes, which may be 10 minutes from now, but if we do it 2 days ago, what's the time to do it? For instance, Jesus heads to Jerusalem. Jesus waits before he goes to visit Lazarus. And he's about this work in a very real way of eating and healing, but he also is, and I'm particularly objecting here in terms of spiritual discernment, but I think that there is a timing to things, too, that we respond to a particular time, and that, to me, is the time when God is intervening in a specific way.
That I would agree with completely. That's why those cities are part of Jesus. That is the time. One thing maybe I'd like to underline is I don't want to put all the emphasis on Jesus. Those three texts that I mentioned are terribly important for me because Jesus didn't settle down at Nazareth with the family, send out messengers to bring people back to him, which any decent leader would have known he should have done, or settle down with Peter at Capernaum and send out the messengers to bring people back to him. He sends out people to do exactly what he's doing. Now, put that in another way, because I'm still trapped in the missionary sending language. He tells people he doesn't have a monopoly on the kingdom belongs to all of us. Now, he is saying something. He's not just saying nothing, because he is telling them that the kingdom belongs to them, which is probably news to them. And that the kingdom is in their hands, just as much in Jesus'. He's not focusing everything on himself. That's why I talk about kingdom movement rather than the Jesus movement. I think by the time it becomes the Jesus movement, we've already made a change. It really is an empowerment. Now I know that's an in word. You could say, well, you're just picking up an in word. No, those are the texts. If people can go out and eat and heal and the kingdom is there, then it's not dependent on Jesus. It's dependent only on Jesus telling you that it's here in your own hands. So I would like to put the emphasis on there's a time when I think he's also saying, in one sense, this was always possible, too. This was always possible, but now maybe you need it badly enough that you can see it. I think I promised you. Okay, I think this is probably a distinction that we need for the next maybe 25 years after we get rid of it, because what's happening in Western science is when we hear disease, we think of it as sort of a microbe, you know, or a virus or something in your body, or some kind of pathogen in your body, and disease then takes it out. Okay. Imagine AIDS. The virus that you could see under a microscope, that's the disease. If, you know, please God, we could actually someday give a vaccine that would destroy that virus, that would destroy the disease. That would be great. Now, granted that disease, I'm working with AIDS for the moment, how the person feels about AIDS, about having shame, whatever, that is part of the illness. How the man he was living with feels about it, that's part of the illness. Whichever way it is, for good or better. The whole spiral that goes out from that, which loops back into it because of worry or stress or anything else affecting your immune system. So the disease and the illness is in a loop. And you can almost imagine the situation in that case where even if the disease was actually cured, the person might not get his job back because he is somehow already, you know, shamed or something like that. So they're both there, and it's necessary to really look at the two of them very clearly to understand how a social situation, it's not just mind over matter, it's how a social situation breeds situations which produce disease like colonialization, malnutrition, illness, overwork. You know, the skeletons of some of these peasants that we found with their arms, you know, pulled almost out of the socket by lifting stuff too much, too often, too long. That's the distinction that I'm making between disease and illness. It's very tricky to see it, but the major thing it does for me is break out of the older system where it was all sort of like there was something in your body and really had nothing to do with you, as it were. You know, like something in your car not quite working and you took your body into the doctor and you did something to your body. And that had nothing to do with you or your family or your society. Yeah. What I got it out of is cross-cultural meta-anthropology. Gentlemen, a minute.
Yes, I wanted to ask a question about the comment that you had made earlier. It's really a two-part question. The first part is more of a clarification. In the comment you made earlier about Christ being baptized with John the Baptist, you said that he had an apocalyptic view of eschatology, and then when he raised up, it turned into sapiential eschatology. I wanted to ask you, are you referring to the historical Jesus, or are you referring to the when you turn the Christ of faith to Jesus?
Historical Jesus. I am presuming as an historical fact. I mean, I'm taking it as a historical fact. Of course, that John the Baptist existed. We know from Josephus as well. And that Jesus was baptized by him. I'm taking those as historical facts. But yet, when I find Jesus in the most original details, I don't find him primarily as a baptizer, but a healer. I don't find him talking about the same sort of things that John was, and I don't find him doing what John did, which is staying in one spot and having people come to him, which is a subversion of the temple center, but it's replacing it with a new center. So, to put all of that together, the only way I can hold it is that Jesus started off, at least in general, accepting John's vision, and then changed his mind.
And the second part of my question is, in view of the Christ of faith, Jesus, what system of eschatology do you view him being, as looking at him as you term the Christ of faith, Jesus?
Okay, now let me go back and take a look at that distinction, because I think that may be part of the problem. Here's the terminology I prefer to use. There is Jesus. He's in Galilee, and people are looking at him. One person looks at him and says, "This guy's really dangerous. This guy's really dangerous. There's going to be trouble. This person is integrated into the Roman support system, let's say. He works for Antipas. This guy's trouble." Now, he's not without faith. Let's say he is Roman, to keep it simple. He has made an act of faith in the Roman law and order. He sees Jesus, and he sees straight through him, and he sees trouble. Somebody else looking at the same Jesus, not calling him Christ or anything else, let's say the word has never been used, and this person says, I think God is at work in this person. What do you mean God is at work? I think this person is divine. I think this person speaks for God and acts for God. And the person says, you're nuts. God is in his temple. God is in the Torah. God is in his people, his land, his God. I see an act of faith, and I'm willing to call it Christian faith, just to make it clear. When a person looks at Jesus and says, here is where I find God. I no longer find God in Rome, or I no longer find God, say, in the temple. I call that Christian faith, that one. And I don't even like the distinction of Jesus of history, Christ of faith, because that is a way, as I said at the beginning, of copying out from the real problem is, how could this person be both crucified and worshipped? That's what you have to be able to explain, whether you like it or not. I mean, I don't mean you, but whether I like it or not, that he shouldn't be worshipped, think it's right or wrong, should be crucified right or wrong. How could people look at Jesus and some people see him as divine and some people see him as criminal? So I don't even need the distinction Jesus of history, Christ of faith. Jesus of history was an object of faith.
Oh, and another question. Unless I am either not understanding terminology exactly correctly, and looking at Old Testament prophecy and looking at Christ's life and the acts that he did, the way it appears when he walked on earth and did all the things that he did. And then looking at Old Testament prophecy, predicting all these things, it appears that it really would not be sapiential eschatology. What would you say about that?
Well, it depends. Let's call them the Hebrew scriptures for the moment. Let's imagine, say, a Pharisee going back to project their future into the Hebrew scriptures. They go into the laws, for example, and they project the future. The early father of Jesus, the learned ones, by the way, as soon as you're reading the scriptures, you're not talking about peasants anymore. You're talking about not only literate people, but probably scholars. They're going back into the scriptures to find something about Jesus. Now, they know what they're looking for. And, of course, they find it. It is there. But so did the Pharisees find it. And it is there, too. So that to go back into your traditions and project your future, one group eventually, I'm making it oversimplified, projected what we call Judaism, and the other group projected what we call Christianity, and then you have separate religions. They both went to the Old Testament, as Christians would have called it, or the Hebrew Scriptures. One produced the New Testament, one produced the Mishnah. If in the year 200 Moses had come back and said, there's two groups and they're both claiming continuity with me, I can't see it, neither of them. I think both of those represented huge leaps into the future based on text. They were there, but there is no way the Pharisees could prove it to the Christians, or the Christians could prove it to the Pharisees. These were two visions going back to different parts of their Old Testament. That is what we have to face. That our way of doing it as Christians is absolutely valid. So is the Jewish way of doing it as Jews. They're both absolutely valid. They're both huge surprises. If you try to figure, you know, in the year zero, what's going to happen? The death of Christ with the destruction of the temple.
So in other words, you're saying that since both of them have, you're saying that both have a different hermeneutic that they use, so therefore you could not use the Old Testament prophecies as a basis?
No, I'm saying it's not so much that they have, in a way they have the same hermeneutic. In fact, even the Romans at the beginning, going back into the Aeneid to justify, they're using the same thing. They're going back into their Bible, the pagan Bible, the Homer, to justify the future of the Julian line. Everyone is playing that game, if you want to. But it depends where you go back to find what you go back. Yes?
Yeah, I'd like to ask you a quick point of view on it. This is a two-part question. I'd like you to give me your view on God's attitude.
I teach in the university. The question was, could I explain God and the afterlife, preferably in 5 minutes? I teach undergraduate students, and I teach comparative religion. So when I think about the holy, I think not only of God in the Christian or Western sense of Islam and Buddhism. I think about Confucianism and Buddhism and other religions as well. And what I understand is that all religions I've ever known or can even imagine have, and I'm going to use a very deliberate term now, a Trinitarian structure. There is some transcendental divine referent. I'm deliberately not saying God, because there is no God in Buddhism. Some transcendental divine referent which is manifest in some material representation, a person, a temple, a book, a people, a land, a hole in the wall, a clearing in the forest, to some believer. Maybe not to the person standing right next to that believer, can't see it at all. So there is a sort of a loop, or as we say in Christian theology, the Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. There is a loop between the referent, the manifestation, and the believer. That's true of all religions. That's the way I approach. God is for me, the holy, I keep it as wide as possible, the holy for me is the infinite mystery that surrounds us. What we're trying to do is talk to it. And in talking to it, we put names on it. And for us, within Christianity, that name is God. It is not the name for Buddhists. And I have no reason to think that the Buddhists are any more right or wrong than we are. And that does not bother me at all. Because human nature is particular. That is, we're rooted in this rather than that. So the fact that other people may be equally true, equally convinced, equally right, does not bother me at all. This is my right. That I don't know. I would prefer, and I think I learned this from Jesus. Jesus spent very little time talking about heaven and the afterlife. And I suspect the best thing we should do, and I mean should do, is to leave the future in the hands of God and accept our responsibility for the present, which will, of course, maybe have something to do with the future. That's what we're called. I think very seriously the statement about God's will being done on earth as in heaven. Heaven's butchered. There's nothing about it. No. Jesus goes on immediately to talk about two things, bread and death. Bread and death. Every peasant in the audience knows those are the two horrors. Not enough bread, too much death. It's the earth he's talking about. So I really think we should stop copying out and talking about the future, which we should be leaving the hands of God, and talk about the present, which is our response.